Ever really think about what separates a split-second reaction from something? Well, something planned. Even just for a moment.
It's a fine line, isn't it? And legally, it's huge.
Absolutely. Today, we're diving deep into a case that really puts that line under the microscope. State v. Guthrie. It explores what happens when a sudden, violent act gets examined for premeditation and deliberation.
Exactly. We're looking at Dale Guthrie. He was a dishwasher, had some psychiatric history, and he fatally stabbed a coworker, Stephen Farley.
And the trigger, if you can call it that, was workplace teasing. Farley snapped a wet towel at him.
Yeah, that was the immediate catalyst. So the big legal question became, was this just a spontaneous, tragic reaction? Or did it meet the standard for first-degree murder?
So we'll be unpacking the trial, the appeal, and what the West Virginia Supreme Court finally decided.
We will, and along the way, we'll touch on those key legal ideas.
Like first-degree murder, what intent means, what premeditation really means in court, deliberation, and how that's different from second-degree murder.
Right. The goal is that by the end, you'll have a much clearer picture of how courts wrestle with these concepts, especially when things happen fast. Super relevant for anyone interested in criminal law.
Okay, let's set the scene a bit more. Danny's Rib House. That's where Guthrie worked.
Yes. And this incident happened in that context of ongoing workplace teasing. It escalated when Farley hit Guthrie with that wet dish towel.
And Guthrie's reaction was immediate.
Immediate and fatal. He pulled out a knife, stabbed Farley in the neck.
Wow. But what Guthrie said afterwards is pretty significant too, right? He confessed but claimed a panic attack, no memory.
Exactly. He admitted to the killing but stated he'd had a panic attack right before and couldn't recall the actual stabbing. That immediately throws the element of intent, crucial for murder, into question.
Yeah, that's a major complication. Yeah. So at the trial, the defense obviously argued against first degree.
Right. They were pushing for something lesser, maybe voluntary manslaughter, maybe second degree murder, trying to frame it as a reaction, not a planned act.
But the jury didn't buy it.
No, they convicted him of first degree murder. They did recommend mercy, though. So he got life, but with parole eligibility after 10 years.
But that wasn't the end of the road. Legally speaking, he appealed.
He did. And a huge part of that appeal was challenging the evidence. Specifically, was there enough proof of premeditation and deliberation? Those are the key ingredients that bump it up to first degree.
Okay, let's really break those terms down then. For first degree murder, what does the law generally look for?
So typically, three things. Intent to kill, that's the first hurdle. Then premeditation, basically thinking about it beforehand, however briefly. And third, deliberation, consciously weighing the decision.
Right. And the Guthrie court had something specific to say about the timing of premeditation, didn't they?
They did. And this is crucial. They emphasized premeditation doesn't need a long time. The court said even a very brief moment between forming the intent and the act itself can be enough.
A brief moment.
Yeah.
But only if the jury believes some reflection actually happened in that moment.
Precisely. If they believe there was a conscious thought process, a moment of reflection, however short.
Okay, so even if it looks almost instantaneous, first degree isn't automatically off the table. How's that different from second degree then?
Well, second degree murder still involves an intentional killing, but it lacks that premeditation and deliberation piece. It's often seen as like, in the heat of the moment, maybe driven by impulse or passion, but without that prior conscious consideration.
Got it. So back to Guthrie. What specific evidence did the prosecution use to argue this wasn't just impulsive? What convinced the jury initially and the courts later?
The key evidence seemed to revolve around Guthrie's actions right before the stabbing. Witnesses saw him reach into his pocket, take out a folded knife, and then physically open it.
Ah, okay, so it wasn't like the knife was already in his hand.
Right, and the court reasoned that the sequence reaching, retrieving, opening provided that necessary moment of reflection. Uh-huh. It suggested a deliberate choice, not just a pure reflex to being hit with the towel.
That makes sense. That sequence implies steps, deliberation, even if quick.
Essentially, yeah. The court is saying even actions that seem almost automatic can be legally interpreted as containing a moment of conscious choice. It kind of raises interesting questions about thought speed versus legal definitions, doesn't it?
It really does. So getting the weapon ready becomes the dividing line. But what about the defense argument? Being snapped to the wet towel wasn't that provocation. Couldn't that lessen the charge?
The court addressed that directly. They basically said, yes, the towel snapping started it, but it didn't meet the legal standard for adequate provocation that could reduce murder to manslaughter.
Adequate provocation being something more severe?
Generally, yes. The law usually looks for something much more significant, something that might cause a reasonable person to lose self-control. Think witnessing a serious assault on a family member, that kind of thing. A workplace prank, even a mean one, usually doesn't cut it legally.
Okay. And what about his psychiatric history? The panic attacks, depression? How did that play into the court's analysis of his intent and premeditation?
That came up at trial. There was psychiatric testimony. It established that, yes, he had these conditions, but crucially, he was found legally sane at the time. He understood right from wrong.
So his mental health didn't legally negate his ability to form intent?
According to the court and the psychiatric testimony presented, no. While it's part of the picture of who he was and his state, it didn't remove his legal capacity to form intent or, importantly, to have that brief moment of reflection the court focused on.
The jury had to weigh all that, including the psychiatric evidence.
Exactly. And they ultimately concluded his mental state didn't prevent finding him guilty of first-degree murder.
Now, you mentioned the appeal. A key point was the jury instructions, right? What was the specific objection?
Yes. The defense took issue with the trial court telling the jury that premeditation could happen in an instant.
In an instant. Okay. Why was that problematic for the defense?
Their argument was that saying an instant blurs the line. It makes it hard to distinguish between the immediate intent to kill, which you might find in second-degree murder, and the requirement for some actual prior thought, some deliberation needed for first degree. They felt it kind of collapsed the two.
So how did the West Virginia Supreme Court rule on that specific instruction? Did they agree it was misleading?
No. Surprisingly, perhaps. The Supreme Court actually upheld that instruction. They basically doubled down, saying the law doesn't set a stopwatch on premeditation and deliberation.
So duration isn't the point.
Not the main point. The crucial factor, they reiterated, is whether that moment, however brief, allowed for conscious reflection. Did he think about the decision to kill? The jury had to find that he consciously considered his actions.
So in that, split second of reaching for and opening the knife, the court says deliberation could happen.
That's the finding, yes. But, you know, psychologically, you could debate how much conscious thought truly fits into such a tiny window.
It seems very compressed. So the act of getting the knife ready, even if it takes just seconds, legally counts as enough time for premeditation if the jury believes a conscious choice was made.
That's the essence of it. And this is where Justice Workman's concurring opinion comes in. It adds a really important layer.
Okay. What did she add?
Well, she agreed with upholding the conviction, but she wanted to be crystal clear that this ruling should not be read to mean that you need any kind of significant or appreciable time for premeditation.
She was worried people might misinterpret the main ruling.
Exactly. She wanted to prevent future cases from setting some arbitrary minimum time limit. She stressed that even a fleeting moment where the intent is consciously formed is enough. No need for lengthy brooding.
So the court really wanted to avoid putting a number on it, focusing purely on the mental state, however quick.
That's it. Did the reflection happen? Did the conscious weighing occur? That's the focus, not the clock. It really highlights how subjective assessing intent can be and how much weight falls on the jury's interpretation of the evidence.
Right. Now, I remember the original text also mentioned some concerns about the prosecutor's behavior during the trial.
Yes. There were issues there. The prosecutor apparently asked some improper questions, made inappropriate comments, maybe touching on Guthrie's potential biases.
Things that shouldn't have happened in court.
Correct. The appellate court acknowledged this conduct was improper. Definitely not best practice.
So why didn't that lead to the conviction being overturned if the prosecutor messed up?
Well, the court looked at it and basically concluded that, yeah, these were errors, regrettable ones, but they weren't serious enough to have actually changed the trial's outcome.
There's a high bar for that, isn't there?
A very high bar. For prosecutorial misconduct to overturn a verdict, the errors usually have to be so bad they fundamentally denied the defendant a fair trial. In this case, the court felt that threshold wasn't met, even though they acknowledged the prosecutor overstepped.
So, despite those errors, the court deferred to the jury, saying a reasonable jury could still have reached that guilty verdict based on the proper evidence.
That's a really key part of how appeals work. Appellate courts don't usually reweigh the evidence or second-guess the jury on facts. They check if the trial followed the law fairly and if there was enough evidence legally sufficient to support the verdict.
And in Guthrie, they decided that standard was met, prosecutorial missteps notwithstanding.
Correct.
Okay, so if we were to boil down the absolute core finding from State v. Guthrie, what would it be?
I'd say it's this. Premeditation and deliberation don't need a set amount of time. But, and this is the key, there must be some moment of reflection, even a brief one, between forming the intent to kill and the act itself.
And if the jury believes that reflection happened, even quickly,
then it can legally qualify as first-degree murder.
And that's the critical difference from second-degree murder, right? The lack of that premeditation and deliberation element.
Precisely. It's that moment of prior consideration, however fleeting, that elevates it.
And Justice Workman's concurrence just hammered home that moment of reflection doesn't mean it has to be long or drawn out.
Absolutely. Making sure the definition stays flexible enough to cover rapid sequences of events where conscious thought, legally speaking, can still occur.
Thinking more broadly then, Guthrie really shines a light on how vital clear jury instructions are, doesn't it? Getting those subtle legal distinctions across accurately.
Hugely important. And it also shows the standard for appellate review, checking for sufficiency of evidence and fundamental fairness, not retrying the case.
You know, wrapping up this deep dive on Guthrie, it does leave you thinking. This legal definition of premeditation occurring potentially in seconds, how does that square with our everyday sense of premeditated? Like when we think of a premeditated act, we usually imagine more planning, right?
It's a fascinating tension, isn't it? Between the legal standard, which can be met very quickly, and our common understanding.
What are the sort of ethical or practical implications of that standard, especially in moments of high stress or conflict? It's definitely something to mull over.
Absolutely. A lot to consider about how the law defines these crucial mental states.